Well, Jeremy, my mom, before we left for conference, even the minor sports are inviting.
I'd like to welcome all of you to our Brown Bag session on midterm elections. Professor Oppenheimer will be our moderator for this session. He is a professor of political science at Vanderbilt University. His research focuses on Congress and congressional elections. He has been a fellow at the Brookings Institution and an American Political Science Association Congressional Fellow. He has published numerous books and articles, including the award-winning Sizing Up the Senate. Professor Oppenheimer is currently teaching an undergraduate seminar on the 2006 midterm elections. So, if you would, welcome Professor Oppenheimer.
Thank you. In case you didn't know, it was the midterm elections. John Deere and I, and I think it was not John Deere's charisma, but John Deere and I gave a talk 2 years ago to during the presidential election year, about the same time 2 years ago, and we had 100 people. And so we're just a little short of that. But if you want to see one of the problems with getting enthusiasm or attention to midterm congressional elections is it's people don't pay as much attention. Voter turnout is lower. The saliency is lower to most people. Ironically, for those of us who are interested in elections and campaigns, it's great because it's a time when campaigns tend to make more of a difference. And they make more of a difference because people know less about the candidates. They're not as locked in as early. By the time we reached the third week in September of 2004, a very high percentage of the people who were going to vote knew whether they were going to vote for Kerry or for Bush. That's not quite the same when we talk about Senate and House elections. People are just beginning to focus on them. Although they are often locked in by party identification, there's much greater volatility, and the nature of the campaign can change things in more interesting ways. Now, having said that, I know that what you're really here to find out is the following. Will the Democrats win control of the House and Senate in 2006, or will Republican control of the House and the Senate continue? And my answer to that is yes. Thank you. And let's try to see it. Let me try to see how political scientists approach this, and then look at how some other people approach this and see if I can give you some estimates, and then take some time and mostly respond to your questions, which are more likely to be about individual races. But let's see if I can talk a little bit about things collectively. A couple of things to note. After the 2004 elections, the prospects for Democrats going into 2006 were not very optimistic. And let me just cite a couple of statistics which might have given you reason to think that the chances of Democrats winning control of either the House or the Senate in 2006, if we were talking in December of 2004, we would have been very pessimistic about it. One, for the past decade, there have been very little variation in the number of seats the parties have had in the House. Republicans have had in the range of 232 at the tops, 221 at the bottom. There had been elections which had been good elections, bad elections for Republicans. Democrats had not threatened the Republican majority since 94. Also disappointing, if you were a Democrat, only 12 Republican House candidates won with a margin of 55-45 or closer. So if you're looking for targets for 2006, there weren't a lot of Republicans running where they had run marginally in 2004. Third, there were only 16 districts which Republicans held members of the where Republicans held members of the House of Representatives, which carried in 2004. So if you want to say, well, there are districts which were really Democratic districts, and Republicans are winning them, there aren't a lot of those. Oh, alternatively, they're not a lot the other way either. But that's another source. And finally, there were fewer partisan competitive districts. That is, fewer districts where the underlying partisanship of the district is such that we might think the district was highly competitive to start with. And that number has been on the decline over a period of years. In the Senate, the Republican margin's bigger, 55-45, 44-1, the Jeffords seat as an independent, so if you want to put it 55-45. And the problem Democrats faced going into 2006 was of the 18, of the 33 seats that were up, 18 were already held by Democrats, or in the case of Vermont, Jeffords. So that meant the Democrats, if they were going to take control, had to pick up a net of 6 seats, but they only had 15 Republican targets to go after, and they had to protect 18 of their own seats. What we realize is Senate classes are not all the same. The next two Senate classes that are up, the one in 2008 and 2010, are much more heavily Republican. This one, although there is a Republican majority in the Senate, there is a Democratic majority in the Senate class. So all those things work. Finally, there are some saving graces. Only very few of the Senate seats up this year are in the South. That's probably good for the Democrats. Of course, they don't hold many of them, so there wouldn't be many to protect. One other problem is they did have 2 seats to protect, 2 Senate seats, in heavy Bush states. That is, states in which Bush carried 60% of the vote or more, both in Nebraska and North Dakota, have Democratic senators up for re-election. So looking at it from the standpoint of December of 2004, did not look like a very good year for the Democrats, potentially in 2006. The idea that Democrats might win control of the House and or the Senate looked remote, and if you were a Democrat, you know, you started drinking heavily, I think that's what you did. And said, you know, I'll wake up from my stupor after the 2006 election, because things aren't going to get any better. Well, what's happened to improve Democratic fortunes? What are the limitations? What do preliminary models say about this election? What can we expect? Well, clearly the fortunes have changed. Democrats are far more optimistic. We have a president whose job approval rating has been hovering 40% or lower, a couple points higher, it depends which poll you look at which day. You have various reports of the generic congressional question gets asked. If the election were held today, would you vote for a Democrat or a Republican for Congress? Democrats have been leading in that sort of generic congressional poll by about 10 points or more on and off. It's gone 8 to 16, but generally it's hovered 8, 10, 12, something in that range. Those are reasons to be optimistic, I guess, if you're a Democrat. The problems with the Bush administration has had, whether it's with Iraq, whether it's with Katrina, whether it's with the state of the economy, whether it's with questions of corruption or confidence, have had an effect on the Republicans' capacity to recruit candidates. One of the things that we know candidates as political scientists, that we know candidates do, is about a year out or 9 months out, or when they have to think about being candidates, they estimate, they look at this strategically. Is this a good year for me to run or not? And so if you go back a year, or you go back 9 months, the picture did not look as rosy for Republicans as for Democrats. So Republicans may have had a little more difficulty in recruiting quality candidates than Democrats. People who you go to and this is your ace, you know, the House member you want to run for the Senate seat, the governor you want to run for the Senate seat, the person with great personal wealth you want to run, you know, the notable you want to run. And you ask them, you try to get them to run. If they're a Republican, they were, you know, say, gee, you know, I think I would. Oh, wait, it doesn't look like a good year. The contrary is that the Democrats had an easier job recruiting first-year candidates. And that makes a difference at the margin. So what does a political scientist look at? How do we get a crystal ball of what we expect to happen in this election? Well, there are a bunch of people in the profession who, and I used to be one of them, but I sold my stock in this after 1994 for very good reason, who were very good at developing models to predict seat change in House and Senate elections. They develop what we call macro pictures of what's going to go on. Which party's going to gain seats, which party's going to lose seats. And while their models differ, their models all plug in many of the same variables. Okay. For example, one of the things they always look at, most of them, are seats at risk. And this is very important, for example, in the Senate. One of the reasons that Democrats don't look like they have as good a chance of taking control of the Senate as the House is they only have those 15 Republican targets to go after. You can't, if you already have something, you can't make a gain by winning it. Right? You have to protect it. So one of the reasons that the Democrats' chances in the Senate are less, although I'll have some comments on this, is they have fewer targets to go after. Second, people tend to look at open seats. The belief has been that, especially in the House of Representatives, incumbency advantage is so strong that when there are more open seats, the out party has a chance of gaining more. When a high percentage of incumbents are running, the difficulty is how do you beat incumbents? We need only point out that in the 2004 election and the 2002 election, 98% of House incumbents who sought re-election were re-elected. However, it is important to realize that incumbency advantage, at least as I look at it, has probably been on the decline. That is, what do incumbents do to make themselves safer? Basically, what's happened and the reasons incumbents are winning so much is the underlying partisanship of the districts has become more favorable to one party or another, meaning that the seats are not in play because of the partisan makeup of the district, not because of whether there's an incumbent there or not. What that means is, well, maybe incumbency advantage isn't as big, but partisan advantage is bigger in House seats, and that means when a seat is open, it's harder for one party to take it away from the party that previously held it. Because underlying that seat is not that it was held by an incumbent who built up and was winning by big margins well beyond what the district was in terms of partisanship. But the reason the incumbent kept winning and kept winning and kept winning was because the district was a heavily Democratic or heavily Republican district. So when it becomes empty, it's not as competitive as maybe would have been the case previously. So, but we still look at that. We usually look at some variable measuring something about the state of the economy. We know that the party of the president does not do well as well in midterm elections when the economy is not doing well. And there are two theories of this. I won't get into them because they're a little technical. But one is based on voters really react to the state of the economy and they vote for the out party, the party that doesn't control the presidency when the economy is not doing well, vote for their candidates in midterm. The other thing is back to a candidate recruitment argument, that is when the economy is not doing well, candidates of the opposition party tend to recruit better candidates. Candidates of the president's party have trouble recruiting as quality candidates. That gets thrown in. What really gets thrown in a big way is presidential job approval. And I'll talk about it. Basically, what do we know about presidential job approval? We know that when the president's job approval rating has been less than 50%, we're not talking about 40%, we're talking about less than 50%, there has been an average mean loss of 38 seats in the House of Representatives. So that's a biggie, right? President job, we know that's related. Some people tend to throw in, they throw in things about stock market. They don't think the normal economy sort of thing. They think people now look at their 401ks and they worry about not whether the economy's improved, but what's happened to their 401k account over the past year. And so some people like to throw that in as a measure of whether how do they get a sense of their pocketbook. We try to throw in measures of candidate quality. You know, somebody goes out and asks, has a challenger run for office previously? That's sort of a baseline measure. If you've got more quality candidates, you're going to win more seats. If you don't have as many quality candidates, you're not going to win as many seats. And finally, we look at this generic congressional vote. You know, if the election were held today, which party's candidate for Congress would you vote for? And on the basis of that, political scientists get some prediction of overall vote for Congress, which they translate into seats. Well, what does this say? What do these models say? There are about three or four people who've done models so far. Oh, and they also plug in midterm president at midterm sort of thing. People believe that makes a difference. What do the models say? Well, there are three or four people who've done really sophisticated models. They vary somewhat in what variables they include. When they look at the House of Representatives, the three people who've done it vary in their point estimates. You know, what does their model predict as an exact estimate? From the Democrats picking up 13 seats, to the Democrats picking up about 22 to 25 seats. It should not be surprising. The person who models it down at 13 seats is a Republican, but that's never. And why does his model come out lower? Just below, by the way, the number of seats the Democrats would have to win to pick up control of the House of Representatives. Why does his come out lower? His comes out lower essentially because he believes there aren't as many seats in play as there used to be. That is, the underlying partisan division in the individual seats is such that it's harder to pick, have enough of a swing, national swing, to pick up more than that many seats. So he says the real thing that he makes an adjust for is how many seats are really in play. The other two modelers who come up in the 20s, their predictions for the House were in the 20s, lower 20s. Now, these are point estimates. They all have confidence intervals around them, right? You know, what is the likely range? So the person who has the 13 seat, his confidence interval is somewhere from 5 seats to 20 seats. And the people who are in the mid-20s are from about 16 seats to about 30 seats. Those are there. Now, what political scientists aren't very good at doing, oh, by the way, in the Senate, almost all these models predict the Democrats will pick up about 2.6 to 2.8 seats. That's like having 2.4 children. That's a problem. But about 3 seats. Again, what sort of undercuts that is the exposure thing. There aren't enough seats at risk for the Republicans. Well, that's what political scientists do. And, you know, we're like economists in that you wouldn't go to an economist to ask you what stocks to buy, right? Just like you wouldn't go to a political scientist to ask you, tell me about each specific congressional race. Well, you might, but we may not have particular expertise on that. So the question is, what about the people who try to do micro stuff and try to predict every race? And one of the best people at doing that is a guy named Charlie Cook, who has Cook Political Reports. And there are a couple other people, Stu Rothenberg, CQ does their estimates. And so I go look at what Charlie Cook has to say, and Charlie Cook's estimates are done on the basis of looking at individual races. And what does he say? And here's what Charlie Cook has to say. And he says, you know, you look at individual races and you get the following latest projections. He lists them into different categories. The seats he labels as solidly Democratic and solidly Republican, which he largely ignores. Ones that are likely Democratic and likely Republican. Ones that lean Democratic or lean Republican. Ones that are toss-up Democrats or toss-up Republican seats. So he has those seats. And here's where you get some potential for the Democrats to make even bigger gains. Currently, he has no Democratic seats in the toss-up category. None at all. There are no seats currently held by Democrats in the House of Representatives that he lists as likely to go to Republicans or in an even contest. There are nine seats currently held by Democrats, which lean Democratic, and 11 currently held, which are likely Democratic. So in other words, 20 current Democratic seats which he thinks are in play. And right now, if he were to look at those seats, he would not predict the Republicans to pick up any seats currently held by Democrats. By the way, there is one Republican seat which he has leaning Democrat, which is the Tom DeLay seat in Texas, because they have some ballot source issues. Okay. If you look at the Republican side of the ledger, he has 20 seats which are likely Republican, 15 seats which Republicans now have, 15 seats which lean Republican, and 19 Republican-held seats which are now toss-ups. So that's pretty interesting. Now I went one step further. And by the way, Charlie Cook says, you know, if you talk to him, he'll say, this could, you know, the Democrats have a good chance of taking control, but this could also be an election where we don't see it coming. You know, where the Democrats could pick up 30 or 40 seats. Not likely, but it could happen. He said you didn't see 1994 coming. 2 weeks before the election, nobody saw that sort of thing. So, all right, that's the optimistic view in the House for the Democrats. Well, let me take a little more pessimistic view, although it's not. Suppose the Democrats don't win any of those seats which are lean Republican or likely Republican. Let's just look at the 19 seats which are toss-ups. Let's say that that's where the Democrats are going to make their gains. Let's say that this tidal wave is not a big tidal wave, it's a small one. What does the partisan makeup of those districts look like? So I ranked one of those districts. This is where I do something different than Charlie Cook does. I ranked one of those districts by the percentage of the vote that George Bush got in the district in 2000. And I counted down, Democrats have to pick up 15 seats to get a majority in the House of Representatives. I counted down to the 15th seat, and I say, what percentage of the votes did Bush get in the 15th seat? 59%. So for the Democrats to win control of the House of Representatives, just by winning the seats now rated as toss-ups, means they have to carry a congressional district where Bush got 15%, they have to win a seat where Bush got 59% of the vote. Now it happens to be that incumbent in that district is in danger, but it tells you they have to really make inroads into areas which are pretty heavily Republican partisan areas. That's a downside. Yeah?
What was that seat?
That seat's one of the Indiana seats. You would ask me that. You might have it here. I may have it here. Hold on. Don't quote me. It's one of the Indiana seats. It's either. It's a Chocolas or what's the other Indiana guy? Hostetler. I can't remember which one it is. Chocola or Hostetler. So I just throw that. Now, suppose I want to be an optimist. I want to go the other way if I'm a Democrat, or a pessimist if I'm a Republican. If I look at Charlie Cook's thing and I look at seats which he rates solid Republican House seats, There are 34 seats which he rates as solid Republican, where the where Bush carried 55% or less in the district. If you got a partisan swing in this election of 5 points, you know, might some of those incumbents who he thinks are totally safe be in danger? Now, I'll tell you one of them's not because one of them's unopposed. No. But if you want to look at the other way around, there may be seats which, you know, his individual scouting on says the Republican should be. You know, for example, he has a seat in Michigan where the Republican incumbent Schwartz lost in a primary to a right-wing Republican. And he has that still as a safe Republican seat. The Democratic candidate is an organic farmer. But this organic farmer got about 45% of the vote last time. So we may think, gee, how's an organic farmer going to win this seat? Well, you know, that's what happens. If there are big sort of tidal waves that go on in elections, not very good candidates win sometime. You know? So my sense is, are all those 34 Republicans who look like they're in safe districts really going to be safe if there's a bigger tide? What about the Senate? Here it's a numbers game. Here you've got a real problem with the numbers game. Democrats need to pick up 6 seats, right, to get majority control. Most people say there are 5 Republican-held Senate seats which are very much in danger right now. Okay. I don't have a screw up. I should look at my list because that'll be easier. Montana, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania. Got my wrong list. Got my Democratic list. Hold on. Yeah, Ohio, Missouri. What happened? Ohio, Missouri. Oh, I'm forgetting one. Okay. But no, not Tennessee. But that Tennessee. Good. I'll go brain dead later on. Okay. But there are 3 others which the Democrats have a shot at. It's thought: Virginia, Tennessee, Arizona. The Democrats have 1 House Senate seat which now seems potentially in danger, which is New Jersey. Whether that is or isn't, we'll see. Most of the projections, either the Democrats, there are 5 seats they could win in the Senate. They can't find the 6th, you know, as they look at them individually. And I think that's the question. Is there a 6th? Number one, will the Democrats win all 5 that are potentially winnable? And is there a 6th? Right now, if you're going to look for a 6th, you'd look either in Tennessee or in Virginia. Those are the 2 races which seem closer than people expected. And we can talk about those individually. But the real problem is, you know, will the Democrats protect all the seats they have? So far, so good, with the exception perhaps of the Republicans thought they had a chance in Minnesota, but the Minnesota Republican candidate has fizzled. They thought maybe they had a chance in Michigan, but that doesn't look very promising right now. They thought maybe they'd have a chance of winning Jeffords' seat in Vermont. That's not very promising. Okay. The big shot is where polling in New Jersey is showing the Republican even or slightly ahead, and where there's some ethical issues with the Democratic-appointed senator who's appointed to fill out the rest of Corzine's time. Corzine had elected. So those are that's what the playing field looks like right now. Now, suppose I do the same thing with the House, the Senate, as I did with the House. To win 6 Senate seats, how far down the list would the Democrats have to go? How big a Bush state would they have to go carry in a Senate race turns out to be Montana, which is one they're probably going to win. But that's a state that went for Bush with 59% of the vote. Precisely the same cut point as with the House. Right? To win control of the Senate, to win control of the House, if you think of things totally in partisan terms, you've got to be able to win in constituencies where Bush took 59% of the vote to get that. Is it possible? Yes, but that's not easy. That's not easy. Now, it turns out in Montana, you have, you know, Conrad Burns, who's got real problems. You know, some people in Washington sort of said, you know, stick a fork in, he's done, even though the polls are showing him behind by 3 or 4 or 5 points. You know, really just an awful shape. So those are really the parameters we're dealing with right now. Those are the parameters we're dealing with. How big is the surge going to be for the Democrats this year? How big a push will they get from sort of the national partisan swing that's going on, which looks like it favors the Democrats? And I think that's really the question. Is it a swing that's going to produce a 10-seat gain in the House, but not 20? Is it going to produce 3 or 4 seats in the Senate, but not 6? That's what we're sort of dealing with. Could things switch back the other way? Sure. But most people can't figure out how that's going to happen. One thing that's really working against the Republicans is the following. You look at that question of job approval rating for the president, and they always give you the approved, disapproved numbers, right? And, you know, there's something like, they change, but there's something like 55% disapproving, 40% approving. You know, these go up and down. We can talk about those. There's problems with this polling data. Well, that's all that very interesting. If you look at this 55%, however, it's composed of people who say they disapprove and people who say they strongly disapprove. The strongly disapprove is 48%. The disapprove is 7%. You look at this 40%, and I don't remember what it breaks, but it breaks closer to 2020. I don't remember which one's higher. That's not too important. This is the number, if you're a Republican, you've got to be afraid of. That you have 48% saying they strongly disapprove, and, you know, Are those people who are likely to vote for a Republican candidate for the House or Senate? That's the thing that I think that is locked into a lot of these surveys. That is the real problem for the Republicans. You know, how do you shift that? And I think that's the real difficulty for them right now. Most of the time, they report that, but nobody ever talks about that. That's the number I would be afraid of. Now, there was a poll out. I turned on Fox last night for some reason. They were touting a new poll, which is a Gallup USA Today poll that all of a sudden showed the generic congressional vote even and Bush's approval rating up to 44%. There are a lot of these run every week or every 2 weeks. You have to sort of look at the average on them because they all have, you know, a plus or minus 4 to 5%. And sometimes you just get outlier polls. There are generic polls which have shown the Democratic advantage up to 16-18% at some times. They're probably not right either. So what you want to do if you want to be a good analyst of this, of both the Bush job approval rating and the generic congressional vote poll, you probably have to average them, look at them all. But don't get too encouraged or too upset by any single one of these polls.
Right. Yeah. I have a question about the President Bush campaigning on behalf of candidates. I would assume that his campaigning on behalf of the candidates would, the results, positive or negative results of that would be related to his approval rating. Is that why some candidates prefer not to have them in their districts?
Well, I think...
Could you talk about
I think there are pluses and minuses of having the president visit. One is you can raise a lot of money for him.
Right.
Two, he can help you mobilize the base a little bit, get people out, cited, et cetera, those sorts of things. Three, he'll get you a day of media coverage in your state or district that you might not otherwise get. He gets you some free coverage because he's coming, right? The downside is his job approval rating is low, and that might hurt you, and especially if your opponent is charging you as being too close to the president on policy issues. You know, the Democrats are running a bunch of ads. You know, people aren't very original with their ads. They pick up something. They're running rubber stamp ads, you know. So-and-so's boom, you know, ad. That's not what you want, right? So, and it depends what the constituency base is. But you can't really, you know, one of the problems is you can't bring the president in, have him raise the money, and sneak him out, you know, and not have people know he came in.
Right? So he stops all the traffic.
Stops all the traffic, you know. As I said to one, you know, he's not coming in on a stealth bomber, he's coming in on Air Force One. So it depends on the constituency, it depends on what the nature of the campaign is. It's not just Bush, some places Cheney's going, you know, how do they treat those visits? Is there the visit, you know, is there the picture of the candidate with the president? Now, 4 years, 2 years ago, 4 years ago, is a different story. Lamar Alexander, 4 years ago, was running on the basis of, I'm the Senate candidate who's going to be closest to what George Bush wants to do. That was a hallmark of his campaign. And Bob Clement's not. There are other problems with the Clement campaign. But, you know, one thing is, you know, Lamar proudly ran on that sort of idea. You know, Bob Corker's not running on that.
You mentioned as political scientists look at these things, they, you know, take into account the economy and the president's approval. Where do the single social issue voters, how are they factored in to these formulas or assessments that people are making?
Well, I think they're factored in not in the overall thing, because they're just, you know, that's already sort of built in, and we're looking at variation from, you know, if we were to look at a Senate race in Tennessee, for example, right, and it was a typical year with no party being advantaged or disadvantaged by issues or the attractiveness of the candidates or anything like that, right, the average Republican candidate against the average Democratic candidate in the average year in the current context, running for the Senate in Tennessee, Republican would win 55-45. You know, the state has that lean. Now, built into that would be some of those single issue voters, you know, where you know you're not going to be able to pull away. But we're saying, well, how is this year different? And, you know, what's this year? And one thing, and we know it's different because of the president's job approval rating. We know it's different because of the nature of the economy. We know it's different because of, you know, something about the quality of the candidate in terms of sort of candidate skills they have. But those are all playing a role.
And
they probably, you know, and that sort of thing goes on across the country, you know. So, and some Republican or independent voters who normally would vote for a Republican candidate may be more likely to vote for a Democratic candidate this year than they would normally be. And fewer Democrats would normally switch over, right? And there may be some effects on turnout, right? If your party looks like it's having a bad year, do voters who are supportive of that party's candidates tend to turn out at a little lower rates than they would normally? Those sorts of questions. Is there more enthusiasm on one side than the other? So you factor that in. But if you talk about, you know, that single issue voter who's never going to vote for a Democrat, or the single issue voter who's never going to vote for a Republican, whether that's single issue, you know, those folks are, you know, they're part of the base. You know, you probably can say even in a state like Tennessee, you know, there's a Republican base. You know, no Republican candidate who hasn't done something totally egregious is going to get under 40% of the vote statewide. And no Democratic candidate is probably going to get much under 40% of the vote. Yeah. maybe it's 45 for Republican, 40 for Democrat. They have a locked-in base. So you're playing for, you know, 15% of the electorate. We're asking, well, what moves that percentage of the electorate back and forth? Yes?
In states such as Michigan this year, with all the auto industry problems, do you think, or do people say that there's going to be a major upheaval in voting?
Well, I think Michigan's one of those, really. Michigan and Ohio are two interesting states. In Ohio, the incumbent governor is not running for re-election, but clearly the Democrats have a real shot at the governor's office. In Michigan, the Democratic governor is probably in much more trouble than she would normally be in a midterm election year, and she's one of the few, you know, Democrats, prominent Democrats, who's in trouble, right? But she still may pull that out. It looks like Senator Stabenow is going to win. What is interesting is there are a bunch of House seats in Michigan where Bush carried the district with 55%, under 55%, where Charlie Cook has them all as safe Republican seats. And so my question is, are they as safe as we would think they would be? But there is not a single House seat in Michigan that he lists as in play right now. So, but the only thing that really looks like it's in play is the governor's seat. Now in Ohio, it's very different, right? Not only is the governor's office in play, but Mike DeWine, that's who I forgot. I forgot got Mike DeWine in Ohio. I knew there was a fit. How did I do that? The Ohio Senate seat is in play, and most of the polls right now show the Democratic candidate, Sherrod Brown, who's a House member, leading by a couple of points. And there are a number of House seats that are in play in Ohio this year. So both those states have been hit hard. Why there are House seats that are in play in Ohio but not Michigan, I think that's a real question. So, yes, that's right. I'd say, gee, there ought to be some effect in Michigan. And except for the governor's office, I'm not sure that anything's going to change there.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how much money is going to influence this? And specifically what I mean by that is, I get a lot of mailings. I've contributed before, and so you get all the mailings.
Yeah. Oh, they get your name. If they get your name, you know, one of the bad things about contributing to a political campaign is you're on a mailing list.
Right. But so what my question is, it almost sounds so fatalistic when you talk about it from a political science viewpoint. How does money raising come into play about this?
Right. Well, one of the reasons that the Senate race in Tennessee is a race in play now as opposed to in 2002 when there was a Senate race is Harold Ford Jr.'s got a lot more money than Bob Clement did. Bob Clement did not have whatever other liabilities or strengths he had as a candidate. He did not have the financial resources to put on a campaign on a level playing field with Lamar Alexander in 2002. Harold Ford's got money this year, can raise money, is spending money with the basis, if I stay close, I know I can go out and raise more money, both in-state and out-of-state. It's going to be a very expensive campaign. You're going to see, you know, it's the first really competitive Senate race we've had since 1994. There is no other statewide campaign. In fact, there's no other statewide or congressional campaign in Tennessee that is close. So it's, you know, if you're a player and you want to invest money in Tennessee, it's the only race to invest money in. No. So is money going to make a difference? I don't know. It's clear that both of these campaigns are going to be very well funded. Corker not only has, you know, Republican base in Tennessee and outside, but his own personal wealth, which he's, you know, he's already invested in the primary $2.25 million of his own money in the last week. So, you know, he's not going to worry about putting a second mortgage on his house to finance the campaign. And if he was willing to put that much in to make sure he had enough in the primary, you better believe he'd invest more of his own money in the general election, although I doubt he's going to have to do that in the end. Look at the number of ads you're seeing so far. I mean, you're just getting saturated. So it does make a difference in some states where you have candidates who are more marginally funded, you know, and you don't want your candidate being terribly outspent in the last 2 to 3 weeks of the campaign. where they can't go up on TV or they don't have the money or they can't respond to the latest attack, that sort of stuff.
What polls show in Tennessee right now?
They vary, but they show it within a point or two one way or the other, at least at this point. Yeah.
How much of the small number of seats in play did in the House as a result of gerrymandering versus other demographic changes and things like that?
Well, I've done some writing on that topic, so you really don't want to get me started, but let me give you a short answer. I happen to believe that gerrymandering has less to do with it than many people think. My argument is, and I have reasons to some empirical tests of that. And the argument I'm making is that part of what has gone on is we're increasingly able to self-select where we're going to live. And when we go through the self-selection process, we self-select on bases which are increasingly correlated with party identification. So that Democrats now live more closely to Democrats and Republicans live more closely to Republicans. And we're easier to put in heavily Democratic or heavily Republican districts. It's not so much what the district, in some states, yes, you can see those districts. But in many cases, we bet the enemy and they are us, right? The POGO line is we're the ones who, of course, we make it easy. We self-select where we're going to live. And increasingly, retirees, college students, people who used to go back home. Nobody goes back home anymore. I mean, if they can, they go somewhere else. If I ask my students, where are you going to live when you get out of college? The ones who are going to San Francisco and New York and Chicago and Boston are different politically than the ones who are going to Phoenix and Dallas and Atlanta and Orlando. And you can say the same thing about retirees. Who's going to Hilton Head in Scottsdale? And who's going to the west coast of Florida? Who's going to the east coast of Florida? And who's going to live outside Madison, in Madison, Wisconsin, because they want a college? And they're different politically. So what you have to realize, that makes it easy. And then when we get somewhere, when we get somewhere, we decide where we're going to live. I came here, my real estate agent knew I was a college professor at Vanderbilt. And, looking at, couldn't find something what we wanted. She said, well, I'll show you stuff down in Williamson County, but I don't think you want to live there. What was that? That was a message. Well, I'm sure she told other people, yeah, you do want to live there. And where do you want to live? And I think, the real estate business plays into it as well. They want to find places you're going to be happy. And that often means we're going to find you places where you're going to be next to fellow partisans, more so than ever before. Long answer to a short question, but you don't want my longer answer. Yes?
Do you think that thinking about the integrity of the polls, electronic voting machines and all of that, is it possible that it could be manipulated and with the close margin of errors, we know the difference? I mean, you as a political science would make predictions, and if they're really off, what's your thinking about that? Those of us that are a little paranoid.
Well, I don't know all the technology, I would be, but I suspect that it's very hard to manipulate them in a systematic way. I think the bigger concern is, do you have a way, if there is some error or something that looks terribly wrong, is there some way of checking it without a paper record? That's the more serious question. Can somebody go in and rig those electronic voting machines? Well, we know over the years, votes have been, numbers get changed all the time. All of a sudden, you took the numbers off a standard old voting machine and you reported them, but somebody transposed a number when they called it, accidentally or not accidentally. Somebody stuffed the ballot box with paper ballots. You have election fraud, which is going on, but to think that it could be done at that large level through an electronic system, which is somewhat decentralized, I find comes close to conspiracy theories, right?
Yeah.
Does that mean there can't be errors or the system can't break down or be faulty? I think that's a bigger concern. Should we be concerned, that voters can be confused by a system? Yes. Do we want to make it fairly simple and direct so they know what they're doing? You know, that's obviously the case. But to say that would be, you know, I suspect if you want to tamper with things, you do that in a more systematic way before people ever get to the polls. You know, discourage people from voting in certain ways. You scare them off from voting. There are several states where there have been efforts, for example, to say that you're going to have a state ID card to go and vote. Well, in Georgia is one of them, and the state judge just tossed that today. So those have been tossed. But those are clearly, you know, you raise the cost of voting to people in some way, which is what that would do. Right? Those, I think, are the things we have to worry about more than, you know, is there a problem with our voting machines? Although it's obviously very nice to have a paper trail so you can check against the paper trail. But we shouldn't think paper trails are always correct.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by the Senate race in Connecticut, and I wonder where that might fall in possibilities. I don't even know who the Republican candidate is.
Yeah, and nobody does, and he's polling, I think, under 10% right now. You know, most Republicans in Connecticut and the National Republican Party aren't doing very much for him.
Right.
So it's essentially a race between two Democrats, and regardless of who wins, there's no expectation that either of them will organize with the Republicans. That is, Lieberman has not given any indication that.
So if he wins, he wants to.
And he says he's an independent Democrat, I suspect. You know, if he decided once he got reelected and went to Washington, that he would suddenly organize with the Republicans, there would be a major brouhaha about that. But I think that's really one you put in the Democratic column for now, because, you know, even the Republicans aren't supporting the Republican candidate. You know, it's like you plug Indiana into the Republican column because Dick Lugar doesn't have a Democratic opponent. Here you have a state. You know, this is what's very bizarre about politics. The Republican Senate candidate, incumbent, does not have a Democratic opponent. Yet three of the Republican House seats in Indiana are among three that are toss-ups right now.
Well, that just speaks to his personal popularity.
Speaks to his personal pop, but this is a state that voted about 60% for George Bush.
I understand.
You know, and these are not, you know. So it tells you something about, well, maybe the quality of your candidates and the quality of your incumbents do make a difference. Those are the sorts of seats Democrats are going to have to pick up if they're going to build a majority. No, that's where the play is right now. It's fun. I love it. I mean, you know, I like it better than presidential election years. You know, the campaigns really make a difference. You get focused on all these different races.
Speaking of presidential politics, do you think that the Democrats have a candidate in 2 years that's attractive enough to win?
Oh, you know, we go back to the thing of what would I have predicted to coming out of the 2004 election about the 2006 election, and you realize how hard it is to predict the future. It's sort of like somebody who wants to write their will in such a way that their money not only gets distributed to their children the way they want it, but to their grandchildren the way they want it. You can't control that sort of stuff. And so it's very hard to predict what are things going to look like in 2 years? Who will be attractive? Who won't be attractive? Who's going to win the nomination? Will circumstances be, what will the president's approval rating be two years from now? We couldn't have, you know, who would have predicted 2 years ago that the Bush approval rating would be 40% or lower for a substantial part of the 6 months prior to the election?
What was my fondest dream?
So if you could tell me what the Bush approval rating will be, what will the state of the economy be like in 2 years from now, then I can tell you whoever is a Democratic candidate, will they be a more viable candidate or less viable? Will they be able to fight the campaign on the issues that work for them as opposed to the issues that work for the Republicans? So somebody you think might not be a very good candidate, you give them the right context 2 years from now, they could be a great candidate.
Bruce, I had a generic question, which is, what do you think can be done to improve the level of political discourse? I mean, it's been reduced to 3 or 4 seconds of a soundbite, and no one on either side of it seems to debate the issues in a meaningful way.
Well, I think it's... I don't want to be totally critical of the soundbite or the negative ads or something like that, but I think this morning, Tennessean ran an editorial. You know, here it is, the largest newspaper in the state, runs an editorial, moaning and groaning about the quality of the campaign and all the negative ads in the Senate campaign, and that the issues of the voters are concerned with, you know, Social Security, Homeland Security, the war in Iraq, that we don't know about the candidates' positions on that. Why do we have the newspaper?
Who's supposed to be finding?
Who's supposed to be writing stories on that? You know, so I screwed up the email, but I was going to send an email to the ombudsman there at the Tennessean and said, you know, isn't that what your paper is supposed to be doing? You know, writing about issues in the campaign? You're not doing it. You know, you're writing all sorts of issues. You're writing all sorts of articles about the campaign ads, but you're not writing about the issues in the campaign. You know, so, in part, I think, you know, candidates are going to do what they think works for them. They're not stupid, you know. And what they know works for them is, you know, relatively short pieces, you know, which emphasize, you know, which give cues as to where they stand, but don't require detail on issues. And, you know, that's, and you're not going to get that out of broadcast media for very much. But, you know, print media, that's what they ought to be doing. Right? So that you, when you sit down at the breakfast table, can open an article and say, hey, here's where they stand on Social Security and what they're doing. It's not just, you know, do you favor Social Security reform, but what would you do, or what are the parameters of what you would do? Or as I like to think, on the minimum wage. Now, you know, you want to know, do you favor an increase in the minimum wage? How much? How soon? And who's covered, you know, and who's not covered? Those are, you know, you've covered people, you know, the latest minimum wage bills that went through Congress, something we don't pay attention to because we're not people who work for tips. Wanted to exclude people who worked for tips mostly from having to get the higher minimum wage. Well, you know, that's pretty important if you're a restaurant or a hotel worker, which there are lots. But, you know, you've got to get a newspaper who has reporters who have, or editors who say, go out and give me a story about this. I think that's where we're really being failed. Print media a lot is failing us.
Well, you know, following up on that, the news media has become so biased, I mean, it's so clear now that there are media who are generating the side of a party.
That's true. That's true on their editorial pages. It's less true in their news stories. And the point is, the big problem is they're not covering, their news stories aren't covering any of this. You know. You know, I was trying to think of the last news story that I saw in the Tennessean that dealt with Corker and Ford's position on issues. Well, they sort of got at it a story when the NRA endorsed Corker. Story a little bit about guns, but it didn't really say what their positions were on guns. You know. They got it a little because they had a big story on what was true and what wasn't true in the ads that they ran. That was sort of peripheral. But, you know, have they run a story on what Corker and Ford's positions are on Iraq? In the Iraq War? Not as far as I know. They run a story on minimum wage. Have they run a story on Social Security? They run a story on Homeland Security? Have they run a story on energy? Yeah. Yeah. You'd like to think that you have, you know, if you have political reporters covering the campaign, that you'd have some of them doing that, especially given the, you know, editorialism. And I don't think TV news can do that very, they can do some of it, really. Right? But for people who want sort of detailed information on issues, you're not going to get it in, you know, a minute and 30 seconds on TV newscast. You may get it on sort of NPR sort of thing.
in, but then the other side or one side thinks that that's biased, or the New York Times is biased, or Fox.
Well, there may be biased, but you know, suppose you're reporting on what they say, you're asking questions about issues. I mean, you know, I watched it, Bob Corker started running his immigration ad again, which he ran in the primary. And I watched that ad, and it's sort of, you know, let's get tough on illegal immigration, let's make our borders secure, and he's down there. But, and he has something about, you know, we should give something about people, people should have the right to work legally. Something about that, I can't remember the exact word. Well, I think that's saying that he favors a guest worker program, but I don't know. You know, so the question, if I were a newspaper reporter, would be, you know, I want to do a story on immigration. Here's a, you know, does this mean you favor a guest worker program? Under what circumstances? You know, what would you know, and the same thing with Ford. You voted for the Sensenbrenner bill, which does this. You know, here's the Senate bill. What would you accept from the Senate bill? What would you accept from the Senate bill? You're going to build a compromise. You know, not, you know, but I think print media has to do that. I don't, and it's not that hard to do, I don't think. But then again, they don't, they probably think teaching political science class is easy. Anything else? Sure. Thank you. Enjoy it. Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
And then everybody has the tickets, so we're going to